see you tonight. So the format of tonight's meeting is a little different. For the last few years, the first couple of weeks of December, we always kind of celebrate and go through Bill Wilson's story, because it's the time of year that Bill had sobered up in the town's hospital. And tonight we'll go through the first half of the story with our guest leader, Chris. And next week, we're also combining it into a little bit of a holiday party. We're going to have a lot of food. So if you want to come early next week at 6:30, you bring your appetite. You will surely enjoy yourself. And, of course, great fellowship and hear the rest of Bill's story. We would like to suggest the following. Some of what you hear discussed in our group may differ considerably from what you frequently hear at other meetings. We ask you to keep an open mind to what is discussed. In this group, we talk about the program of recovery that was practiced by the first 100, as is written in the Big Book. If you cannot reconcile something we say about the program of recovery or something that somebody else says with either the Big Book or the 12 and 12, then we suggest you disregard that information or consider it suspect of error. We'll start, as always, with the suicide prayer. Dear God, please set aside anything I think I know about myself, about my disease, about the Big Book, the 12 steps, the program, fellowship, people in the fellowship, and all spiritual terms, especially you, God, so may I have an open mind, new experience of all these things. Please help me see the truth. Before I give the meeting to Chris, I've asked Will if he would read from the 24-hour book.
December 8th, Lord for the Day. The length of time of our sobriety is not as important as its quality. A person who has been in AA for a number of years may not be as good in as good mental condition as a person who has only been in a few months. It is a great satisfaction to have been an AA member for a long time, and we often mention it. It may sometimes help the newer members, because they may say to themselves, if they can do it, I can do it. And yet the older members must realize that as long as they live, they are only one drink away from a trunk. What is the quality of my sobriety? Meditation for the day. And greater works than this shall ye do. We can do greater works when we have more experience of a new way of life. We can have all the power we need from the unseen God. We can have His grace, His spirit, make us effective as we go along each day. Opportunities for a better world are all around us. Greater works can we do. But we do not work alone. The power of God is behind all good works. Prayer for the day. I pray that I may find a rightful place in the world. I pray that my work may be made more effective by the grace of God.
And with that, I would just like to introduce Chris S. Chris is a good friend. He's been here at this group a number of times. It's always a pleasure to have Chris here, where he shares his insight and his good stories. And welcome, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you, John. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. I really enjoy being at this group. This room holds some really, really strong memories for me. Back about 10 or 12 years ago, there was a number of really influential people in my life who were asked to come up here and speak. And a couple of them are past now. This particular church, this particular group, has been known for a very, very long time to have strong recovery, strong solution-based meetings. And I, for one, certainly appreciate that. A little bit about me. I started to show up in AA in the 80s and made a firm commitment to get sober, whatever that meant. I knew it meant not drinking alcohol anymore, but that's about all I understood. I made a firm commitment to get and stay sober and started going to AA. And I truly believed that I was engaging in a program. I was going to anywhere from 7 to 14 meetings a week. I would take on commitments, whether it was a coffee commitment or a secretary commitment or whatever. I was You know, I was bringing people to meetings. I was going out to the diner afterward. I mean, I really thought I was getting A's in Alcoholics Anonymous because of the amount of participation I was putting into it. I mean, I was really making my life into AA. And I thought that doing all of that stuff was a program. And what happened in my life was emotionally, spiritually, I just continued to deteriorate. The further away from a drink, the less life really was enjoyable for me. One of the characteristics of alcoholism is separation from alcohol does not all of a sudden make things better. If it does, if all of a sudden you stop drinking and everything starts to get better, you're probably a problem drinker. You're probably not an alcoholic. So what happens with alcoholics is we slowly go insane without the booze, because we've got no way to take a vacation from ourselves and our minds and our emotional states. That's what's the real problem for alcoholics. So here I am. I'm going to a gazillion meetings, and I'm not doing any of the behavior modificational work that happens in steps and with really good sponsorship. I'm just staying sober, and I'm going to a whole lot of meetings, and I'm losing my mind. Now, I was exposed to a couple of people, a few of them who actually spoke in this room back in the very early 90s. And the message that I got from these individuals was, Chris, if you're not working the steps out of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you do not have an AA program, because that's what an AA program is. You're engaged in fellowship activity, which is good in and of itself, but it's not going to bring about recovery from alcoholism. It's not going to get rid of the dangerous states of mind that exist in the alcoholic. So I was exposed to these people, and over the course of time, I slowly bought into the message that they had, and the message that they had went right back to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It was no newfangled AA. It was old-fashioned big book recovery AA. And I started to work an AA program rather than a meeting program or a CRIS program. And I started to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And since that time, I've made it a point to share that message, because there are a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous today thinking they're doing the deal, really thinking they're doing the deal. And that's so far from the case, especially if they're in real trouble with alcoholism. That's far from the case. And I don't want to contribute to that misinformation that can be given either directly or either implicitly or through misunderstanding that attendance at AA is a treatment for alcoholism. It's not. Now, getting a chance to do Bill's story, obviously, I'm influenced by Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson was the principal architect of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. He took the spiritual concepts and spiritual practices that were available through basically some religious and evangelical groups and organizations, and put them into a format that an alcoholic could swallow. They found, prior to AA, they found that there was a way to overcome that obsessive drinking, and that way was a path of spirituality, but it also had to be a path of action. So spiritual principles had to be involved, but spiritual action also had to be involved. Bill got exposed early on through his attendance at the Oxford group, learned what worked, what was best practices back in those days for staying sober and recovering some sense of sanity as an alcoholic. And he paid close attention to those best practices and was able to architect them into the recovery program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. So, without Bill Wilson's pioneering work, I would not be alive. I would either be dead or I would be in an insane asylum because I have a really bad case of alcoholism and it doesn't get better separated from alcohol. I needed some type of transformational process to recreate the whole structure of my outlook, my attitude, my personality, everything. It had to be huge. And being exposed to the 12-step recovery process as it was outlined basically by Bill and some of the first 100, I survived today. So, you know, being asked to do Bill's original story, one of the iterations of the very first drafts of this story is a great honor for me and a great privilege. And, you know, I've learned a little bit about Bill Wilson over the years. I've read all the biographies. I've listened to all the tapes. The tapes will put you to sleep, you know, if you listen to too many of them, because he would talk like this. Every single word that he said was phenomenal, you know, unbelievable, but he was not a dynamic speaker in any case. So I struggled through, you know, probably 30 or 40 Bill Wilson talks. I can't really say I understand the man. I don't know that anyone really understood the Bill Wilson. He was remarkable in many capacities. Some of the things that people might find surprising was, by the time the 60s came around, he really wanted out of AA, but there was really no way for him to leave. He was getting involved in vitamin B12 therapies, and he wanted to move on to other things, and he felt that he was being pulled back into Alcoholics Anonymous. He couldn't really leave. And there was a regret that he had the last 10 or 15 years of his life, that he was so ingrained in Alcoholics Anonymous that he couldn't move on to the next thing. And he really couldn't because his phone never stopped ringing. This is back during the day when they didn't count minutes. If somebody called you, it didn't cost you any money. So he would, you know, people would call him and he'd sit on the phone for hours. He gave so much of himself. He really set aside his wants and his desires to be sure that Alcoholics Anonymous would mature as a fellowship and the program of recovery would stay intact and would be available to the sick and suffering generations to come. And we can be very, very glad of his, we can be very grateful of his sacrifices. Now, this particular story even predates the manuscript version. I believe, John might correct me, I believe this was probably one of the drafts that was passed around and, you know, some changes were made to it before it went into the original manuscript, and then some changes were made in it, a few changes were made in it before it hit the big book. But this is probably Bill's first major effort at telling his story on paper. When the idea came to print a book with the recovery process in it, they figured, and it was a good idea, they figured that personal stories would help people identify and would make this a more personable process. I sponsor an editor, a New York City editor, and he gets a lot of spiritual books. He's got his own spiritual book line. And what he pushes people to do is he pushes people to tell personal stories. Because we connect to them. We connect. When someone tells a story, it's better than just reading a bunch of lecture material. It's better when we actually are engaged with the person and we're told a little bit about their life. So they decided that they were going to put stories in this book. And that was going to be an important part of the book. For me today, the stories are not an important part anymore. I've already identified, you know, I'm an alcoholic, okay? You don't need to convince me that I have alcoholism. You don't need to convince me I need the recovery process. I'm not someone that pours over the stories anymore. However, there's an important part that they play, especially early on in the identification process. So I'm going to start Bill's story. I think everyone has copies. And as I usually do, I'll interrupt myself about 3,500 times. At the age of 10, I went to live with my grandfather and grandmother. Their ancestors settled in the section of Vermont in which I was to grow up. Poor Bill came from a broken family, and you got to understand, back at the turn of the century, that was kind of, you know, a scandalous thing. His father disappeared off into Canada to run mining operations, and his mother left him with the grandparents to go become a doctor or something. They say, "Hey, Bill, here's the grandparents. See you later." You know, up in Vermont. If anybody's been to the Wilson House in East Dorset, Vermont, they know where he grew up. It was the sticks. Okay? He was, here's grandma and grandpa. They run a big bed and breakfast. See you later. Grandfather was a retired farmer and a lumberman. He nurtured me on a vigorous pioneering tradition. And when you see the Wilson House, you'll understand what they meant. I mean, the heat was like from fireplaces. I see now that my grandfather was the kind of man that helped make America. Little did anyone guess I was to be of the war generation, which would squander the savings, the pioneering traditions, and the incredible stamina of your grandfather and mine. It's kind of being hard on his generation. I don't see it that way today. Ambitious but undisciplined that I was, there was a genius for postponing, evading, and shirking, but a certain dogged obstinacy, persistence drove me to succeed at special undertakings upon which my heart was set. I'm starting to identify already, okay? I will postpone anything that I can postpone that I don't want to do. I will evade, I am conflict avoidance, you know, I will go around the back, if that's an easier, softer way, every single time. And shirking, I am really, really good at delegating. I don't call it shirking, I call it delegating. Because I'm a manager. You know what I mean? But I also, if I set my mind to something, man, I can make some things happen. I've made some really serious stuff happen in my life. And it's because I'm interested in it and I'm motivated by it. It's usually my idea, you know what I mean? And so I can totally identify. Especially did I revel in attacking the difficult or the impossible. Grandfather, for instance, said that no one but an American could make and throw a boomerang. No schoolwork was done, no wood box filled, and little sleep was there until a boomerang had circled the church steeple, returning to almost decapitate him. Having accomplished this, my interest ceased. So it was with my ambition to be a ball player, for I was finally elected captain of the team at the little seminary I attended after leaving country school. Someone told me I could never sing, so I took up voice until I had appeared in a recital. And then, as with the boomerang, my interest ended abruptly. I had commenced to fuss with the violin. This became such an obsession that athletics, schoolwork, and all else went by the board, much to everyone's consternation. I carried fiddling so far I failed to graduate. It was most embarrassing, for I was president of the senior class. This is, you know, when I see somebody that's acting like this, I know they're an alcoholic, you know. Listen, I decided that I was going to learn the guitar. I took two guitar lessons and stole the guitar from the teacher. All right? I decided I was going to join the wrestling team. I went to one practice. I decided I was going to join the Boy Scouts. I went on one camping trip. You know, these things just didn't work out the way I thought that they were going to work out, so I'm gone. I went to college. I spent 5.5 years in college, and I got like 9 credits. You know, that's like not even possible. You know, because it would get to the end of the course, and I'm not interested in an exam. I don't do exams. And Bill was like this too. He did the same thing with his law degree. He was this close from becoming a lawyer and decided not to take the final exam, you know? It's just so perfectly alcoholic. We shoot ourselves in the foot and then we rationalize it until the cows come home. So collapsed a certain legend of infallibility I had built around myself. Repairing this failure, I attempted to enter a leading technical school. Because of fierce enthusiasms I had displayed for matters chemical and electrical, it was assumed I was destined to become an engineer. At Boston, I failed the entrance examinations dismally. My people were heartbroken at my self-sufficiency got another severe deflation. Finally, I commenced electrical engineering at an excellent military college where it was fervently hoped I would get discipline. No such thing happened. As usual, I had good grades when interested, but often failed when not. There was an illuminating instance concerning my calculus teacher. Not one formula would I learn until all the theory underlying the subject was made clear. Could you imagine what a pain in the ass this guy was to try to teach? He was one of those guys that knew more than the teacher, I can guarantee you. At the library, I pored over the researches of Leibniz and Newton, whose genius had made calculus possible. Loving controversy, I argued much with my instructor, who quite properly gave me a zero, for I had solved only the first problem of the course. That's beautiful. And yet, you know what you need to do to get past idiotic behavior like this? You gotta have a drink. That's what you gotta do. You know? Because it's just too much to bear, this type of abject failure. At this juncture, and quite conveniently for me, the United States decided to go to war. It was convenient for him. You know, it worked out in his favor that 22 million people got killed. We students bolted almost to a man for the first officer's training camp in Plattsburgh. I was commissioned a second lieutenant of artillery, electing that branch rather than aviation or infantry. For when I lay in my bunk at night, I had to confess I did not want to be killed. This suspicion of cowardice bothered me, for it couldn't be reconciled with the truly exalted patriotism which took possession when I hadn't time to think. Later, under fire abroad, I was relieved to learn I was like most men, scared enough, but willing to see it through. I was assigned to a post on the New England coast. The place is famous for its Yankee trading and whaling traditions. So the post, he actually ended up over in England, but World War I was a very short war. I think it was only a couple of years long. My grandfather fought in it. My grandfather tells a story. He was walking down the streets of his hometown one day, and a month later he was in the trenches fighting the war. They would put you through basic training on the ship over. It was a very quick war, but it was pretty devastating. So if he was assigned in New England, he didn't see very much action. Two far-reaching events took place here. I married, had my first drink, and liked it. My wife was city bred. She represented a way of life for which I secretly longed. To be her kind meant fine houses, servants, gay dinners, cultivated conversation, and a much envied sophistication. I often felt a woeful lack of poise and polish. These inferiorities were later to drive me cityward in quest of success, as I suppose they have many a country boy. My first marriage, I married a woman whose father was the president of one of the Chrysler Motors divisions. She spent most of her life in these palatial mansions with chauffeurs and butlers and nannies and gardeners and all this stuff. And all of a sudden she hooks up with me. That was a culture shock, I'll tell you. You know? Because I resented having to get insurance on the car, you know? That was too much for me. So her whole world was blown up pretty quick. That marriage was 12 of the happiest months of my life. War fever ran high, and I was flattered that the first citizens of town took us into their homes and made us feel comfortable and heroic. So here was love, applause, adventure, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. I was part of life at last. Notice how he took his first drink, and now he's starting to think he's part of life at last. That's the way it was for me. I was a repressed, anxious, very socially awkward, very uncomfortable kid. And then I drank alcohol, and I burst my seams. All of a sudden, I was the funniest guy. One of the most traumatic experiences of my life. Is anybody in here old enough to remember square dancing in school? Okay. Oh my God. I don't know about anybody else's experience, but here I am. I'm about 10 or 11 years old. And what they would do is they would bring the women, the girls' gym class and the men's gym class together. and they would line all the girls up on one side of the gym, all the boys on the other, and they'd blow a whistle. And you'd have to run across the gym and ask a girl to dance, and then they'd start playing the music. That's traumatic for somebody like me. I'm worried about rejection, you know? I can say, I'm not dancing with you, you loser. I mean, they've already been told they have to say yes, by the way. But you know, I mean, it's just traumatic for me. I to this day, it's like a nightmare, you know, running across, you know, trying to find somebody to pick. You know. Oh, my God. Give me a pint of whiskey, and I'll wait for them to come ask me to dance. You know what I mean? It's like a whole change in perception. You know, they'd be lucky to, you know, I mean, it's a whole complete shift in perception. So what it did was it awakened me to being part of life at last. Alcohol was never my problem. It was a solution to a much deeper problem within me. That repressed, anxious adolescent was the problem. Alcohol solved that. It was like an anti-Chris's fear potion, you know? And all of a sudden, now I can go. I can step out. I've always just wanted to be able to step out. You know, so I know what this guy is talking about. Now, if alcohol would have continued to work that way and not cause horrific damage in my life, that would have been a good thing. But that's not my experience. Alcohol turns on you over a period of time, and now it creates its own set of problems. You know, so that's really basically what happened with me. My gaucheries and ineptitudes magically disappeared, and I discovered the siphon and the Bronx cocktail. Strong warnings and prejudices of my people concerning drink evaporated. There was alcoholism in his family. Then came parting with its bizarre mixture of sadness, high purpose, the strange elation which goes with adventure, having fatal possibilities. Many of us sailed for over there. Loneliness seized me only to be whisked away by my charming companion, Prince Alcohol. I'll tell you, there's nothing like the loneliness of the chronic alcoholic. It is the most pathetic thing. How it manifested in me was, you know, I knew it was dangerous for me to go out my last 3 or 4 years of drinking because I'd get arrested or something. You know, it was really bad for me to be in public because I drank. I got it done when I drank. I was tongue-chewing, knee-walking, not able to operate my own pants zipper drunk in about an hour. You know what I mean? I got it done. So, but what I would do is when I started drinking, I'd get lonely. So I'd pick up the phone. Any drunken dialers in here? Oh, my God. I would come down the next morning and see the phone numbers by the phone, and I'd be horrified. You know, I would have called a girl I knew from 8th grade or something. Oh, no. And of course, I didn't remember any of these calls. And this one time, you know, and sometimes I'd get resentment, so I'd call up and I'd threaten people's lives, which caused its own problems. Remember this one time, I don't remember it, but it happened. I called my boss up about some resentment at work that day, and I quit. And I said, I'm quitting, I'm going to kill you, too, I'm going to kill you. And because I was in a blackout, I went to work the next day. Walking, you know, like nothing. What are you doing here? Like, what? What's your problem, man? You know, you threatened my life. No, I didn't. Yeah. So, I mean, just not wanting to be with myself. I just couldn't take myself after a while, you know? And it would be even worse when I would stagger uptown to a bar, I mean, or something. You know, that wouldn't go well either. But the tragic chronic loneliness that the alcoholic suffers from, you know, it's palatable. We were in England. I stood in Winchester Cathedral with head bowed in the presence of something I had never felt before. Many of us have had spiritual experiences. What they ask us to have in Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual awakening, which is similar but but more long-lasting and of different quality. A spiritual experience, I've had many spiritual experiences, you know, like when I was young on the perfect, you know, the perfect vacation or something, or Christmas, you know. Christmas was like a spiritual experience for me when I was a kid. I've had many, many touches with the divine. Here he gets probably his last holistic sense of the divine, standing in Winchester's Cathedral. And probably from then on, the only spiritual experiences he was going to get was out of the bottle, you know. Where now was God, the God of the preachers? Across the channel, thousands were perishing that day. Why did he not come? Suddenly, in that moment of darkness, he was there. I felt an enveloping, comforting presence. Tears stood in my eyes. I had glimpsed that great reality. In the book Alcoholics Anonymous, they talk a lot about the consciousness of the presence of God. As a recovered alcoholic, you are gonna understand the consciousness of the presence of God. That really is part of the fourth dimension. That really is part of that intuitive spiritual plateau that we have to land on to remain recovered alcoholics. But if we only can grab it here and there at a chapel in war or something like that, we're in big trouble, because we need to have constant access to this realm of the spirit. We just do. Much moved, I wandered through the cathedral yard. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he died by musket or by pot. My mood changed. A squadron of fighters roared overhead. I cried to myself, here's to adventure. The feeling of being in the great presence disappeared. He was staged in England, right across the channel from D-Day, is where he was right now. This was a critical time for America, for the free world. We were invading Germany and the German occupied territories to keep the world from becoming a fascist empire led by a psychotic dictator. You know, this was a serious period of time in American history. Homecoming arrived at last. 22 and a veteran of foreign wars, I fancied myself a leader, for had not the men of my battery given me a special token of appreciation. You know, I've read a lot about Bill Wilson, but I never read him describing how he operated in his battery. Like, what was some of the action that he saw? Was he a mortar? Was he cannon? To this day, I still don't know. I'd really like to know that. Anyway, leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would manage with the assurance of a great pipe organist at his stop and keys. So, another thing that I got to stop and I got to identify with, because that's the whole point of this story, is having a sense of inferiority coupled with a huge ego and self-centeredness. This is the hallmark of the alcoholic. You know, we're shy to go into, you know, a place with a lot of people, but we should be running it. You know what I mean? It's just really, we're really wacky. Soon enough, I was brought to earth, a position at half the army pay from which I was presently discharged as a poor and rebellious bookkeeper was the first salutation of unsentimental industry. My resentment was so great I nearly turned socialistic, which in Vermont is downright treason. Humiliation and more came when my wife got a much better job and commenced to pay the bills. I fancied my new city friends were snickering at my predicament. Unwillingly, I had to admit that I was not trained for anything. I know all of these feelings, by the way. Characteristically, I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. Though drinking was not continuous, it frequently disturbed my wife. We had long talks when I would still her foreboding by saying men of genius conceive their vast projects when jingled. that the most majestic constructions of philosophical thought were so derived. I used to say that. You know, Jim Morrison, Ernest Hemingway, you know, all of those tragic geniuses were alcoholic. You know, I'm in good company. They'll write songs about me when I'm dead, you know. It's just crazy thinking. When the law course was done, I knew the profession was not for me. The inviting maelstrom of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Reminiscent of the boomerang episode, I became wholly absorbed and fascinated. Out of the tissue of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight and all but cut me to ribbons. Both at work and living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000. It went into utility stocks, then cheap and unpopular. I rightly imagined that they would someday have a great rise. Failing to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managements, my wife and I decided to go anyhow. Bill Wilson came up with one of the first great ideas as far as investment due diligence is concerned. A lot of people never left Wall Street. They would just invest in companies, you know, with very little real background on the companies, they had the bookkeeping records, but they didn't really know. So he said, you know what, I'm going to go around, I'm going to visit these companies. I'll drink in the bars where the people go to work, go after work for drinks. I'm going to get to know the real scoop on these businesses. And that's the idea he came up with. And he took off down the eastern coast and stopped at all these big businesses, drank with the people in the bars, camped out with his wife and his motorcycle at night, and wrote reports back to Wall Street. By the time he got back to Wall Street, people started to believe that this guy had something here. This gave us more information for us to invest more wisely. So he became a stock speculator analyst, one of the very first ones. I had a theory that people lost money in stocks by not knowing markets, managements, and the ideas at work in a given situation. I was to discover lots more reasons later on. We quit our positions and off we romped on a motorcycle and a sidecar, stuffed with tent, blankets, change of clothes, three huge volumes of financial reference service. Our friends almost wanted a lunacy commission appointed. Perhaps they were right. There had been some success at speculation, so we had a little money, though we once worked on a farm for a month to avoid drawing on our capital. It was the last honest manual work for many a day. The whole eastern United States was covered in a year. At the end of it, strangely enough, my reports sent back to Wall Street procured for me a position there and the use of what seemed to me a large sum of money, the Wall Street expense account. The exercise of an option brought in more money, and we had several thousand dollars profit. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. I had arrived. My judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. And he was drinking like a fish during this. He would be on Wall Street during the day and go to all the bars at night. Back then, a lot of business was done in the bars. You know, it's kind of changed. Wall Street has kind of changed, like in the last 20 or 30 years. But there was a period of time where much, much of the business was done in the clubs, on the golf courses, in the bars, in the limousines, in the parties, you know. He was right there in it. You probably couldn't have had a more perfect person for that type of a job. The great boom of the late 20s was soothing and swelling. Drink was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. Loud talk in the jazz places uptown, we all spent in thousands and chattered in millions. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. Of course they didn't, and I made a host of fair-weather friends. My drinking had assumed more serious proportions, going on all day and nearly every night. And this is back when you could drink. Anybody in here watch that show Mad Men? It's a cool show. It's about the advertising agencies in the early 60s. And there's not a time when somebody doesn't have a cigarette or a bourbon in their hand. And this is during work, you know. When they get in the morning, the first thing they do is pour a cocktail. We're in a whole nother generation now. But it wasn't like, oh my God, this guy's drinking vodka at work back then. It was like, could you drink like a man, was the question. We don't care that you're drinking. The remonstrances of my cooler associates terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. There were many unhappy scenes in our apartment. This, by the way, was large, for I had rented two and had the wall between knocked out. There had been no great infidelity. Loyalty to my wife and sometimes extreme drunkenness kept me out of these scrapes. Maybe. In 1929, he was a blackout drinker, so how do you really know? In 1929, I contracted golf fever. That is a terrible illness. We went at once to the country, my wife to applaud while I overtook Walter Hagen. But while I, you know, Tiger Woods would probably be the person you'd say now.
Yeah.
Golf permitted drinking both by day and night. It was fun to carom around the exclusive course, which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan seen upon the well-to-do. With amused skepticism, the local banker watched me whirl fat checks in and out of his till. Abruptly, on October 1929, the whirling movement ceased. Hell had broken loose on the New York Stock Exchange. After one of those days of inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to a brokerage office. It was 8 o'clock, 5 hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at an inch of tape. It bore the inscription PKF 32. It had been 52 that morning. I was done, and so were many of my friends. You could buy stock back then. I believe they call it by buying it on margin. In other words, you could borrow $10 and buy $100 worth of stock. You could buy it on margin. If that stock goes up, you just sell the stock, and you've made a ton of money by putting like $10 in. But if the stock goes down, you're gonna suffer a loss too. So a lot of people thought that they were a lot richer than they were because they owned all this stock on margin. And, you know, it crippled a lot of people. The paper said men were already jumping to death from those towers of Babel that were high financed. That disgusted me. Going back to the bar, I felt glad I would not jump. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock, so what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. You know, that determination, that the removal of fear, alcohol can do that to us up until the very end. Alcohol can do that to us. You know, I'm worried about, you know, I stayed home from work today. You know, I didn't feel like going in. I'm worried I'm going to get fired. Oh, my God. And my boss leaves a message on my voicemail or something. You know, oh, man, he's going to fire me. And you go out to the bar and you have a couple of drinks and three or four drinks into it. Let him fire me. You know, he doesn't deserve me anyway. You know, and that fierce determination to be one's own man, you know, is in that bottle. There's a lot of different things in that bottle for people like us. Next morning, I called a friend in Montreal. He had plenty of money left, so he thought I had better come up. By the following spring, we were living in our accustomed style. It was like Napoleon returning from Elba, no St. Helena for me. But I soon excelled as a serious and frivolous drinker, and my generous friend had to let me go. This time we stayed broke. Now, he knew if he continued to drink, he was going to lose all this. He knew that. But as an alcoholic, he also didn't understand at that point in time that wanting to not drink is not a safe protection. It's not a defense against the first drink. Wanting to the most of your absolute ability, wanting it to the depths of your soul to not drink anymore, is not a defense against a drink for an alcoholic. That's why we relapse so often. That's why we make 1,000 decisions not to drink and end up drinking to cement that decision in. I mean, you know, like, I'm going to quit drinking tomorrow. I might as well get really drunk tonight. I mean, you know, all those things. We went to live with my parents-in-law. That must have been fun. I found a job and lost it through a brawl with a taxi driver. How do you lose a job with a brawl through a taxi driver? Must have been bad. Mercifully, no one knew I was to have no real employment for 5 years, nor hardly draw a sober breath. My wife began to work in a department store, coming home exhausted to find me drunk. I became a hanger-on at brokerage places, less and less desired because of my habits. He must have been pathetic, you know, drunk out of his mind, walking into these brokerage houses. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a bathtub necessity. Bathtub gin, 2 bottles a day, and often 3, got to be routine. because of prohibition and stuff like that, you would take medical alcohol. It's like 200 proof alcohol. You'd mix it with some distilled water and what did they use for gin? They used pine, some type of pine needles or something.
Juniper,
yeah. And they mixed some juniper in, and that's what basically bathtub gin is. I used to do toilet bowl lewds, but I never had bathtub gin. Sometimes a small deal would net a few hundred dollars, and I would pay the bars and delicatessen. Endlessly, this went on, and I began to wake early, shaking violently. A tumbler full of gin followed by half a dozen bottles of beer would be required if I ate any breakfast. Wow. Like this guy's bad. I mean, he's drinking when he gets up in the morning. The howling mind is going to be on him if he doesn't calm it with the booze. So he's around the clock chronic alcoholic at this point. I still thought I could control the situation. There were periods of sobriety which would renew my wife's hopes. But things got worse. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died. My wife became ill, as did my father-in-law. Then I had a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point in 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in its profits. I went on a prodigious bender, and that chance vanished. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take even one drink. Anybody in here ever here in the meetings? You just don't take the first drink? Bill knew that years before he was able to stop drinking. Knowing that you shouldn't take the first drink is not a defense against taking it, unfortunately. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business. And so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone pushed a drink my way, and I'd taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective came near being just that. This is what happened. He had been sober for a couple of months. He was playing golf because he didn't have anything else to do during the day. And he sat down at a bar and he was going to have a milk or a soda. And he started telling this bartender about his alcoholism. He said, "Yo, man, I'm a chronic alcoholic. I am bad. Alcohol near killed me. I was drinking 2 quarts a day. I lost my career. You know, I was 10 pounds soaking wet. You know, I was insane. It was just absolutely horrible. You know, my wife worked. I'm slowly struggling myself back. I'm trying to find a job, you know, And the guy's like, "Wow, you know, thank you so much for being so honest about your life." And then he goes, "Could I have a double?" The bartender goes, "Are you crazy? After what you just told me about your drinking, you're going to start drinking again?" And he goes, "Yeah, I must be crazy. Make it a triple." And he started drinking. Now, the obsession of the mind, the powerlessness over alcohol, manifests in a number of different ways. That's one of them. Knowing just how badly alcohol has done you, and then drinking again, that is the insanity, that's an aspect of the insanity of alcoholism. And it manifests in us. That's why we can't get away from the booze. That's why the American Medical Society Association says that alcoholism is a chronically relapsing condition. That's what it's called. Because normal alcoholics chronically relapse. They get periods of sobriety, yeah, when they get dried out, but they chronically relapse because of that obsession of the mind, that inability to stay separated from alcohol. That's what Bill's real problem is here. In his last 3 or 4 years of drinking, he's really trying to quit. He knows it's no good, and he's trying to quit, but he can't stay separated. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of... I missed one. Sticking to my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed. Confidence began to be replaced by cocksuredness. I could laugh at the bars. Now I have what it takes. One day I walked into a place to telephone. In no time I was beating the bar, asking myself how it had happened. The whiskey rose to my head. I told myself I would manage better the next time, but I might as well get good and drunk just then, and I did just that. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning is unforgettable. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. the hideous four horsemen galloping through your room. Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. This is when many of us commit suicide. Do you know that as an alcoholic, you're 60 times more likely to take your own life than a non-alcoholic? Important warning statistic if you're new or just coming back. You know what I mean? Get this thing under control. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably. There was a terrible sense of impending calamity. It's because calamity was impending. I hardly dare cross the street lest I collapse it and be run down by an early morning truck because it was scarcely daylight. That's the terror. That's the heightened anxiety. And an all-night place supplied me with a dozen glasses of ale. My wreathing nerves were stilled at last. A morning paper told me the market had gone to hell again. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a mental fog settled down. Jen would fix that. So two bottles and oblivion. Who here has drank for oblivion? You know? Aunt Fanny and Uncle Fudd don't have a glass of wine for oblivion. You know? Only alcoholics do that. The mind and the body is a marvelous mechanism, for mine endured this agony 2 more years. Sometimes I stole from my wife's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window or a medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. I used to hold a .38 caliber handgun, loaded handgun up to my head, just praying for the courage to pull the trigger in my last 2 years of drinking. Never did it, but I coulda, you know. There were flights from the city to country and back as my wife and I sought escape. Then came the night when the physical and mental torture was so hellish I feared I would burst through my windows, sash and all. Somehow I managed to drag my mattress to a lower floor lest I suddenly leap. He lived in a rooming house, a big boarding house-like place. Dragging his mattress down the stairs, that's a public hallway. And he's like sleeping on his mattress in the hallway. Just bizarre. A doctor came with a heavy sedative. Anybody in here get heavy sedatives from their doctors? Yeah. And the rest of you lying good for nothings. Next day found me drinking both gin and sedative without the usual penalty. The usual penalty is death. It says, you know, do not drink alcohol on this medication. I used to weigh him in my hand and chug him down with vodka. I mean, that, you know, no alcohol, yeah. I always drink alcohol when I'm doing 30 Valium. I don't know about you. You know, that's what I do. This combination soon landed me on the rocks, and my wife saw something had to be done quickly. People feared for my sanity, and so did I. When drinking, which was almost always, I could eat little or nothing. I was 40 pounds underweight. My brother-in-law is a physician. Through his kindness, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation for alcoholics. Under the so-called belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Belladonna and hydrotherapy are really stupid. You know, hydrotherapy is they gurney you and they hit you with hot and cold waterheads. And, you know, they clean you up, but it's not going to help your alcoholism. And belladonna is like a poisonous hallucinogenic weed. Hallucinogens never did much for my alcoholism, I'll tell you that. Not that I didn't try. Best of all, I met a kind doctor who explained that though selfish and foolish, I had also been seriously ill, bodily and mentally. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholism, the will is amazingly weak in concerned drink, though frequently remaining strong in other respects. This is the obsession of the mind. This doctor, Dr. Silkworth, is explaining the obsession of the mind to him. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. I'm going to stop here, and we'll pick up here next week. And basically what we've covered is what it was like and a little bit about what happened. We're going to finish out what happened and what it's like today. This story really is a 12-step call in print. You know, that's really what it is, and we'll finish it up next week. Thanks.